Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, May 7th. As the war in Iran drags on, we're starting to see the squeeze on our oil supplies. Hawaiian Electric customers across the state are starting to be charged more for their power, what to expect, and how to manage costs. Families who were affected from the back-to-back storms in March can now get assistance from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, what you need to know about the upcoming deadlines. State lawmakers are wrapping up the legislative session. It ends tomorrow. We talk about one of the more controversial actions they took and what happens now. And on the long view, we look at the last 50 years, what has changed for the country and for Hawaii. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Happening now, customers are paying more for using electricity thanks to the conflict in the Middle East. Hawaiian Electric warned that customers may see a hike of about 20 to 30% because of the war in Iran and the blockade in the Strait of Hormuz, where oil tankers normally pass to get fuel and oil across the globe. Some customers started seeing the price hikes about a week ago, and those higher rates due to the volatility of the price of oil are being rolled out across the state. Today we hear from Hawaiian Electric Company's Jim Kelly. He's Vice President for Communications, and we talked to him earlier this morning about what you need to know about keeping the cost down.
Hawaii was one of five states that had seen electric rates going down in 24 and 25. Where all other states were seeing their rates going up, and so we were actually in a place where we were close to having, probably since the last war, the Ukraine Russia war in 2022, we saw a spike in rates, and those had actually our rates had were back down to the level that we saw before that conflict. So we were heading in a good direction, and so having this happen obviously is not good news for most households and businesses.
So talk about the time frame. You know, who's seeing it first and how is it getting rolled out?
These cost increases don't hit people for about 60 days. So most of the time we're buying oil and what we paid for it doesn't show up in people's bills until about 60 days later. And so that's whether it's going up or whether it's going down. So Oahu started seeing the increases in April. Toward the end of April, neighbor islands, for the most part, will see the increases in May and probably a little bit into June. And then I think we're hoping that it's going to stabilize at that point, and then maybe with any luck, depending on the geopolitical situation, start heading back down.
Well, you know, we are seeing stories that as prices go up in so many sectors, they're saying it might be a while before those airline flights actually get reduced. And so that's a bit worrisome. And like you said, summertime is when those bills normally go up because of the AC use.
Yes. And I think, you know, I really want to convey a couple of things. I mean, one is that I know it doesn't feel like it, but I think people have control over their bills and how much they use. And I think we've all been conditioned at this point. I assume everyone has changed out every incandescent light bulb in their house over the last 10 years and is now using LEDs, or all of the kind of low-hanging fruit, I think, has been grabbed in terms of energy efficiency. I think this is the point. And I'm going to get up on my own soapbox on this because I've done it myself at my house. I think this is the time that, with rates going up, people really got to, you know, desperate times calls for desperate, drastic measures. I think people really have to look closely at how they use electricity in their house. You mentioned air conditioning. That's one of the top energy users. And I think if people are in the habit of they sleep every night with the air conditioning on, I think you've got to maybe think about, okay, can I get out of that habit? And especially before it gets really hot, can I not use the air conditioner every night and use a fan? At least maybe two nights a week, try that. I think you got to look at everything that generates heat. Your water heater is the number one energy user in most houses. I have experimented with turning it off and taking short showers. And if you turn it off for a couple of days, that water stays fairly warm in there, depending if you got a decent water heater. You should experiment with how long you can go with the water heater turned off. It makes a big difference on the bill. You can see it. The dryer, the old hanging up clothes instead of using the dryer. Well, it makes a difference. Stove, oven, can you have sandwiches or use the rice cooker or use the toaster oven or the microwave instead of the oven, that kind of thing.
Or go outside and barbecue.
Yeah, go outside and barbecue. Going back to the air conditioner, people have got that cranked at 66 degrees. That's going to use a lot more energy than if you've got it at 76 or 78. And even little stuff like the computer and the printer that's on all the time. Yeah, that's not going to drop your bill by $50 if you turn it off, but it's being conscious of those kinds of things.
And for folks who have electric vehicles, I know we were on the shift and save, and so we changed our habits where I was trying not to charge my car, you know, during the peak times and it during the day. But then I don't really know. Am I saving money by still, you know, doing it in the daytime, or?
It depends on if you're on that rate or not. If you were on the rate before, then I think you should still be on it. And yeah, if you can do it during the day, that's going to save you money.
Okay, so that's another cost-saving thing to look at.
Yeah, I mean, people shouldn't just throw their hands up and go, well, there's nothing I can do. I think there are things that people can do, or at least, like I said, experiment with some things around your house and it really can make a big difference. Just between the water heater and the air conditioner, I think you'd really be surprised. I was, how much it saved when I just stopped using it.
And we know folks often have that second refrigerator in the garage or a freezer. And those are energy suckers too.
They absolutely are. And again, if you've got it cranked all the way, like I experimented with my freezer in the kitchen, and you know, it was, everything was frozen solid because it was at maximum, and so you got to really make sure that it's not. And same with the refrigerator, you got to try to find a more moderate setting, and that's going to make a big difference.
If people start to see these bills rise, I mean, I know you folks announced you also have a payment program. What do we need to know about that?
So if you want to call us up, and I really want to make the point, you know, our customer service, it's all local people. They're all people that are paying electric bills too. And so if you call up and you say, look, I'm struggling with this new higher bill that I'm paying right now, and we can work with you to try to come up with a payment plan. Right now we're saying we can stretch that out over 6 months, interest-free, and you can come up with a number with them that is going to be more comfortable for your budget. And hopefully in the next couple of 3 months, I hope this all gets resolved and we can go back to where we were previously. But everybody is empowered in our customer service area to work with individual customers to try to work out with them something that can help them stick to their budget. And we're very flexible. We want to just make sure, as long as people are giving us something every month when they get the bill, we can work with them.
Okay. And then, you know, I know during the Kona Low situation and in the weeks that followed, there were a number of outages. And one aspect, I know that you folks were trying to get the word out, you know, you had some major transmission lines that feed East Honolulu, and those were damaged during the high winds.
Yes. And it was just last week that we were able to. So there's three high voltage transmission lines that go over the Ko'olau and serve Windward Oahu and East Honolulu. And one of those had gone down earlier in February. And if you see the video that we put out, I mean, you can see what a difficult location this transmission structure was at. So we had to get helicopters in to lift equipment and to bring crews up there. And the weather was not cooperating through most of March when we were dealing with the Kona lows. And so having the windward side, East Honolulu, operating on either one or two lines during storms is not the optimal setup. And so we're really happy once the weather cleared, we were able to get our crews up on top of that ridge that you can see. And it's very treacherous. And as they said, it was probably one of the most challenging assignments of their career. Guys had worked with the company a long time to get up there. What they did was they put in wooden poles temporarily to replace the structure that had fallen, and just to get that line back up. And then over time, we're going to have to design and engineer a steel structure that will go back up there, because that's a critical piece of hardware. But yeah, so now we're back having three lines serving the windward side in East Honolulu, and just in time for what should be a exciting summer, potentially, given what the Weather Service is saying about El Nino.
Yes, you know, because we could have more storms and more intense storms, which is not a good thing.
No.
We were very fortunate last year to have below average storms, but then, you know, we got hit by these back-to-back Kona lows. As far as then anything else that you folks are doing to improve resiliency on the neighbor islands?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is all tied into a long-term resilience program that's also connected to wildfire safety, replacing thousands of poles. When we replace a pole to make that line more resilient, that's doing two things. You're going to and we've already seen it pay off in some of the data that we've collected, that areas where we've gone in, we've replaced poles and lines in high wildfire risk areas. We're seeing that when we then have a storm come through afterward, that there's much less likelihood of those poles coming down, obviously, unless a 10-ton tree drops on them. But it really makes a big difference, and we've replaced thousands of poles. And really, and we focus, like I said, in the high wildfire risk areas primarily, but it is definitely making a difference.
And we will be hearing more about, you know,
yes,
this as we get into the summer months, just to be able to emphasize the resiliency and what people can do to help as we navigate through the hurricane season.
Yes, yep, absolutely.
Okay. And then I know that you are also going to be on a panel, I think it's next month, the Hawaii Chamber of Commerce, talking about fuel and prices and all of that.
Yes, all of that. I mean, I think
it's a lot.
We keep saying this is, it's absolutely true. And this is everything that we're seeing geopolitically, everything we're seeing in relation to climate and the impacts in Hawaii. We've got to be talking about having more options available and looking at all kinds of different options for generating electricity in a way that's going to be safe and reliable and is going to save people money.
We've been talking with Hawaiian Electric Company's Jim Kelly. Look for links to that payment program later today on our website, as well as info on that forum. And a note, Hawaiian Electric Industries is an HPR underwriter.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Gas, offering tips to help local residents and businesses prepare for natural disasters and emergencies. Learn more at hawaiigas.com/safety.
President Trump has put his face on huge banners hanging from federal buildings. He's looking at you from new national parks passes. And now special U.S. passports will have Trump's image superimposed over the Declaration of Independence.
The symbolism says America is Trump.
Why authoritarians put their faces on everything. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for HPR comes from Costco Air Conditioning and Refrigeration, featuring Daikin Air Conditioning Systems. Listing of contractors installing Daikin products, that's Daikin, at CostcoHawaii.com.
You know, we have been reaching out to various federal agencies as disaster teams have been dispatched to help with recovery from the recent storms throughout the Pacific. We heard from the Small Business Association and from the Environmental Protection Agency. And today we hear from FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. We hear from a familiar voice. Hiro Toya is FEMA's Incident Management Assistance Team Leader. He used to lead the city's emergency management team, and he spoke with us earlier this morning about the financial assistance that the federal government is making available for those who suffered damages from the flooding and high wind events from 2 months ago.
First off, our hearts go out to those who were impacted by the Kona low storms in March. You know, it's hard to believe some of the folks, they were impacted almost 2 months ago. And we know that it's a long road to recovery. We do have a presidential disaster declaration, and we have some federal programs activated to be able to help with some of the costs of recovery. So we have a program called Individual Assistance that's available to provide direct assistance to those who are impacted by the storms. And to register for those, folks can visit disasterassistance.gov. or calling us on our 800 number, and that's 1-800-621-3362. We also actually have in-person assistance available in each of the counties. So for Oahu, we have personnel at the Wailua Courthouse, at the Key Project, Waianae Coast Comprehensive Health Center, the Haula Civic Center, and this Saturday we're going to be at the BYU Hawaii. And that's on Oahu. On Maui, we're helping out in Kahului at the Maui Mall. We're at the South Maui Community Park Gym in Kihei. We're also at the Lahaina Resource Center. And we had a center open on Molokai yesterday, and we'll be going back over the coming week to provide in-person assistance. And, of course, last but not least, Hawaii County. We do have personnel at the Keala Kukua Public Library and the Puna Keala Armory. And starting later this month, we're going to be in Na'ale'i. But all that information is available on ready.hawaii.gov, along with the dates and times of operation for each of those sites. So folks can visit us online or over the phone or at these local recovery centers to apply for assistance.
Well, you know, it was just such a shocking experience, you know, to see the visuals that were coming in of the devastation across the state. I mean, from those gigantic boulders that rolled down near Waimea to just the roads that were, you know, washed away on Maui, and then, you know, the devastation on Molokai and the Big Island and so on. I mean, and this wasn't, you know, a hurricane, right? These were just unusual back-to-back storms that just caused all this incredible flooding.
Yeah, and of course, anytime disasters happen, we always say that disasters start locally and end locally. And we're really relying on that local leadership and working with each of the counties, with the state, and with the federal government coming in to provide support. And that's been our entire approach here, is to really rely on that local leadership. And, you know, they're the ones that know the community the best. They're the ones that have an understanding of complexities of working in a community like Hawaii. And we're providing the support under that leadership. So it's just from day one, you know, it's been a community-led. And from the days of the actual flooding occurring, it's we've witnessed neighbors helping neighbors and the local first responders providing assistance. And so we're coming in behind them, providing support and providing assistance to those affected communities. And, of course, we are providing assistance to the individuals who are affected. We do have a deadline to apply of June 14th. And what we want to do is to be able to provide assistance as quickly as possible to those who need it. So what we want folks to be aware of is that there is an application process. You know, you need to have a form of identification and some proof of residency in that home that was impacted. And what we also need to work through is insurance. So folks who have insurance, they should go ahead and file their insurance claims. And where we can help out is any damages that aren't covered by insurance, we may be able to provide some assistance. So the types of assistance we can offer is for temporary housing. If people are displaced from their homes, we may be able to help out with some of the costs while they're displaced. And if there's longer-term needs, we could also potentially help out with costs to cover rent. And if there are other personal property-type losses, anything that's not insured, we may be able to help out. So anybody who was impacted by the Kona low storms from March 10th through 24th, I want to encourage them to apply for the FEMA Individual Assistance Program. And, you know, one thing that that I've heard some folks talk about, you know, I've been able to talk to some of the survivors, and, you know, they feel like maybe others have had it worse, that their situation's not so bad, and they feel blessed with what they have. So they've kind of shied away from applying for further assistance. But, you know, that person applying for assistance isn't taking help away from anybody else. So just really want to encourage anybody who was affected by the storms to go ahead and apply for our assistance through FEMA. And our partners at the U.S. Small Business Administration, despite the name, they can actually also help with low-interest disaster loans to repair your home. So really encourage everybody to take advantage of the programs that are available right now.
Yes, and the SBA said, you know, they were encouraging people to apply because they said this doesn't, you know, hold you to accepting the money, but you can certainly see if, you know, you're eligible, and then you can make a decision. But they do want to, you know, make sure that the people who are affected and are eligible for that help, you know, can get that assistance to get them back on their feet.
Yeah, and that's right. And the SBA loans are available not only for small businesses, but also for residential properties. So if your home was affected and you have some substantial rebuilding requirements, or you think you might, you can go ahead and apply for that disaster loan and have that available to you in case you need it.
And the FEMA assistance, is that more just a grant?
Yes, the FEMA assistance would be grants for those who are eligible. So what we can do is provide assistance if you have immediate needs, if you have to evacuate, or if you have prolonged power outage and you have some immediate needs to cover sort of day-to-day expenses. We can help with that, as well as any kind of cost you might have incurred while you're displaced. And if you needed to evacuate and stay at a hotel or other places, we may be able to provide some funds to cover that. And, you know, if there are longer-term needs, we can potentially provide assistance to cover costs of rent. And if there are any sort of personal property losses that were not covered by insurance, including your vehicle, you know, if you didn't have insurance or underinsured, there may be some funds available to assist with that.
Okay. And then, you know, I know you had mentioned that you just came back from assisting with the wildfires in California. But, you know, I'm not real sure if any of our FEMA people here have been dispatched over to the Western Pacific, where they were hit with the super typhoon, or is that another disaster team that's helping out over there?
Yeah, so we currently have personnel on Guam as well as Saipan helping out with the disaster over there. And then we also have a dedicated team here in Hawaii. We're working side by side with our partners at the state, as well as with the counties to provide the assistance programs here. So, you know, one of the things we talked about the assistance that we're providing to individuals and households. And again, the deadline to apply for that is June 14th. But what we're also doing is we've seen substantial damages to roads, infrastructure, and to public property here. What we're also doing is providing assistance to the state and the counties and certain nonprofits in a program called public assistance. And essentially what we're able to do is to provide reimbursement to those eligible government entities as well as eligible nonprofits for damages that they sustained during the Kona low storms. So we are working very closely with the state in implementing that program. The deadline to apply for that program, and again, this is for government entities and certain nonprofits, that deadline is today at 6 p.m.
We've been hearing from Hiro Toya, FEMA's Incident Management Assistance Team Leader for Region 9. Look for links for the FEMA programs and the schedule of meetings on our website later today. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Hawaii. In this this week's Backyard Quiz, we're paying tribute to Hawaii Congresswoman Colleen Wakako Hanabusa. Her memorial service is underway at the Hawaii State Capitol. The trailblazing wahine who grew up in Waianae pumping gas at her family's service station became a state senator in November of 1998 after making a name for herself as one of the state's top lawyers. She represented the 21st District, which included her hometown of Waianae, as well as areas like Ko'olina, Nanakuli, Maile, and Makaha. In 2006, she became the first female president of the Senate and the first Asian-American woman to preside over a legislative chamber in the U.S. She was elected to Congress and returned home to serve as chair of the Honolulu Authority for Rapid Transportation. Hanabusa never forgot her roots and to many was known simply as Auntie Colleen. To celebrate Hanabusa and her roots, today's question is one locals will know all too well. What school she went? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for families of agricultural workers and retirees, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation. NareitHawaii.com.
Live from the Atherton presents Next Wave Jazz at Hawaii Public Radio. Join us as we celebrate Hawaii's rising artists featuring the Lucas Utley Ensemble on May 23rd and the Christina Sokor Trio on May 30th. This event is primarily standing room with limited seating available. Get your tickets now at hawaiipublicradio.org. This event is sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from Small Business Chamber of Commerce Hawaii, partnering with HMAA to provide health insurance for businesses across multiple industries. Learn more at smallbizhawaii.com.
The state legislature's final day is tomorrow, and today lawmakers are in session. And this morning, they've been paying tribute to former Senate President and Congresswoman Colleen Hanabusa. Hanabusa's laying in state in the Senate chambers. And joining us this morning is HPR's Ashley Mizuo. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, and so it's a nice opportunity for the lawmakers just to remember her contributions to the state.
Yeah, I think as we heard earlier, you know, she was the first female Senate president. And now, of course, we have our first female House Speaker at the same time. And so I think it's a really interesting thing that they're doing today.
Yeah, yeah. And it's nice that they're able to do it just before the session ends. You know, they will be taking some final votes tomorrow. What are some big things yet to tackle?
Yeah, so the two main outstanding bills for tomorrow are going to be the adjustments to the state's income taxes, which is going to include most of it is going to stay the same for most people. Higher income earners are going to see pauses on those income tax cuts that were coming down the pipeline over the next couple of years. And then they're also including a new income tax bracket that would be for millionaires. That's slightly higher than what is currently levied. And then another bill that we're waiting for a final vote on tomorrow is the one that would get corporations out of elections. It could be a precedent-setting piece of legislation that could set a precedent for the rest of the country.
Yeah, and obviously, though, one thing that one controversial bill that they did vote on has to do with the green fee. Much ado about that, but not all the money is going to, you know, the actual list that was drawn up by the council.
Yeah, I think the green fee was, of course, the tax on tourists, which is supposed to be designed to pay for climate projects. The funds were supposed to go to three project areas: protecting natural resources, increasing climate resiliency, and sustainability. sustainable tourism. So yesterday it was included in the state budget, which passed unanimously. But I think when the list of projects actually came out, it raised some eyebrows. You know, the governor's Green Fee Advisory Council, before session started, had recommended a series of projects and then sent them to the legislature at the start of the session. And then the legislature finalized that list and then passed it in the state budget yesterday. I spoke with Green Fee Advisory Council Chair Jeff Mikulina about the list.
In large measure, it does accomplish those original goals. Of course, it doesn't have everything that, you know, the council was asking for. There's some other projects in there, some interesting things I think we believe are aligned with that original intent. And then some other projects that, you know, you could have some healthy debate about whether or not that fits. But by and large, it is in line with what I think folks were expecting these dollars to go toward.
I know when I talked to him last week, he was saying that he did an analysis and he said about 61% of that list, you know, went to, you know, clear environmental projects. But not everything.
Yeah, I think it's a real mix. So, you know, while, you know, some of the projects remain the same, like there are millions of dollars for coral reef and ahupua'a restoration, you know, wildfire reduction, retrofitting homes to withstand hurricanes, there are some that are kind of, like you said, outside of the scope of what the funds were supposed to be used for, which is climate-related projects and sustainable tourism. There's like a $200,000 allocation for a cattle slaughterhouse, $350,000 for a sports and signature event study, $800,000 for ADA compliance at Waipahu High School. And then I think one of the most interesting is the largest allocation of any project on the list, which was $7 million for a food and product innovation network. Here's Mikulina again.
You're right. There are some projects in there that are certainly head scratchers, where it would require some creative imagination to shoehorn them into that original intent. And that's not to discount the merits of any of those projects. I think there are a lot of advocates who think, hey, a slaughterhouse is one of those critical pieces for overall food sustainability. But does it align with that original intent? It is a bit of a stretch. That said, Act 96 that created the Green Fee, while the legislative intent was very clear, the legislature, you know, can choose to do what they'd like with these dollars. And that's perhaps something that should be explored in the future to really ensure that the dollars are being put to work for that original intent.
Yeah, and I know that there are some people that are concerned that this Green Fee Fund is going to be just a lawmaker's slush fund, you know, and they may push back on some of these projects.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of interesting to look at how we got these types of allocations that maybe look slightly outside of the scope. And I will say, like, a lot of the projects are within the scope. So it's not like the legislature took the list and then completely obliterated it. It's just more, there are just some projects in there that doesn't necessarily seem 100% aligned with what the law had said. And so, you know, in the law, it says that the governor's budget request to the legislature has to fall within those three buckets I talked about earlier. But it doesn't necessarily mandate that the legislature has to do anything with those three buckets in the final budget. So they can kind of decide what they want to do with those funds. House Energy and Environmental Protection Committee Chair Nicole Lowen says there needs to be some guardrails around the power the legislature has to spend the Green Fee funds.
That's why I like the idea of deciding what are some important buckets we think funds should go into, and just deciding up front, we're going to put some funding in these buckets. For example, we know there's a desire to do a lot to support community groups and community stewardship. And I think that could be a program managed by the departments where they could open up for grant applications and then use their expertise to decide and sort of take some of the politics out of it, of this is in your district or my pet project.
And I think a lot of the projects that were included that seem a little bit out of scope were included by the Senate Ways and Means Committee, because when the House passed the budget out, it was pretty much aligned with what the Green Fee Advisory Council had first recommended. But Representative Lowen had introduced a bill that failed the session that would have put portions of the Green Fee into special funds dedicated to particular issues like watershed conservation or like wildfire prevention. And then that way, you know, the idea was that these funds would be specifically catered to these types of issues. And then the legislature could then use their discretion for a portion of the Green Fee funds, not the whole $130 million. But despite these changes, the Hawaiian Council Destination Stewardship Director, Carmela Rizuma, another member of the Green Fee Council, pointed to the project allocations as progress.
I looked at that and I said, we are better than before. You know, I'm forever like a glass half full kind of person. And just looking at the progress, at this point last year, we didn't have projects. We didn't have the millions that are going back into community, into Aina. And I would celebrate that. I tell folks, I, you know, publicly, privately, is it perfect? No. Is it better than it was last year? Absolutely. I'm looking at this like the long game. So what matters now is how we implement with integrity. And I say that as a collective, we, not just the legislature or the agencies, but as a collective community advancing this work forward together.
In the Green Fee project list, there are some allocations for status monitoring of how the Green Fee Fund projects are progressing along. So there are some guardrails in there, and that will hopefully know how these funds are being implemented and the progress of a lot of these projects. There's still a pending lawsuit by the cruise industry that may impact the amount of funds available. From that point on, you know, Governor Green could restrict the funds and not release it if that's the case. I know that one of the things that was talked about was when they're trying to decide if the funding gets cut and how to decide what projects would be cut from the list. It would a lot of it would have to do with the project readiness, whether or not it was ready to go and be implemented immediately. So we'll have to see. And then also Governor Josh Green can still line item vetoes in the budget, which he would announce, you know, towards the end of June.
Yeah, but there's still some head scratchers. I mean, nothing against American Disabilities Act, but you're like, what? How does that work with the green fee?
Right. And I think that that was one of the issues that was raised when it was passed, was that, you know, the governor can request whatever in the budget, but the legislature ultimately has the power to make those actual allocations and really form what the budget is. And so if you don't put those guardrails around the legislature, they're not really there at all.
Yeah. Well, we plan to follow up and ask those hard questions about, how does this work? But thank you so much, Ashley. We've been talking to HR's Ashley Mazzullo. You can read her story about the green fee bill online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Big Island Coffee Roasters' Kau Red Bourbon. Bourbon is a coffee variety known for its sweetness, full body, and fruit-forward flavor. Now available at BigIslandCoffeeRoasters.com.
This week on This American Life, Julia's neighbors terrorized her family for years. They shut out the lights in front of their house, burned obscenities into their lawn, and they had this lawyer.
And he said, they're lying, Judge. They're all lying. Even the little girl, she's lying too.
And when Julia's family finally gets the upper hand, they have to decide how to use their power. Because like Spidey says, with great power, you know.
Beginning Saturday at noon.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Hawaii Department of Transportation, congratulating all graduating seniors. Actions such as planning sober rides home can help graduates live their best lives ahead.
And now it's time for the answer to today's backyard quiz. We wanted to pay our respects to Congresswoman Colleen Hanabusa. She served as the U.S. Representative for Hawaii's 1st Congressional District from 2011 to 2015 and again 2016 to 19. A fourth-generation Japanese-American, or Yonsei, Hanabusa never forgot where she came from, often engaging in issues that affected Native Hawaiians and protecting programs that served the people of Hawaii. Hanabusa was known for being a dog lover, even sending out a fundraising plea in 2012 written by her dog, Little Hanabusa. A choice quote from that email reads, "Trust me when I say that Colleen works like a dog for us in Washington." We asked you to tell us where she went to high school. And the answer to today's quiz, Colleen Hanabusa was a proud alumni of St. Andrew's School, at the time known as St. Andrew's Priory. Colleen Hanabusa passed away last month and is survived by her husband, John Souza, and her two dogs, Franny and Pepper. And congrats to our winner, Matt from Waikiki. You got it right. That's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
. 2026 is quite the year. It's the 250th anniversary of the beginning of the United States of America and the 50th anniversary of Hawaii's Hokulea, a symbol of the Hawaiian Renaissance. Here with the Long View is our long-running contributor, Neil Milner. Good morning, Neil.
Good morning. Still running long.
Yes, and I know, you know, this 50-year mark, you know, because for 50 years you called Hawaii home, and so it really gives you a chance to reflect on, you know, what all this means.
Oh, absolutely, and we'll save that for last, because I showed up a little bit before the Hokulea and a little bit after the Hawaiian Renaissance started, but my 50 years there were really the heart of much. So I want to talk about three different things, two involving the Pew Foundation and the other involving a piece by Vicky Buniono, who just wrote a piece for the Star Advertiser about the Hokulea. The Pew Foundation has done two recent studies, one of which is, what does America look like the 50 years after the centennial, which the centennial was July 4th, 1976. They also took a look at what changes there are among Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders. This is mostly economic and demographic. It's just sort of a skeleton. But there's some interesting stuff in there about how the country's changed. And in some ways, it's changed pretty dramatically over the past 50 years. This is nationally now. There was a big increase in immigration during the 50 years period. And we'll talk about what's happened to that in a minute, mostly from Asian and Hispanic countries. And this immigration really drove the population increase more than anything else. So the first thing, and it's the thing that you notice if you've been around cities and you see that they look more diverse than they did before, racially and ethnically, and places before, like where I grew up, which was in the Midwest, was basically a meat and potatoes place, now reflects its diversity with an enormous diversity of restaurants of all kinds. So that's one thing. The immigration was up, diversity was up, women in the workforce increased. But then on the other side, even though people were making more money, at least it appeared that way, the income gap increased. In 1976, you were still seeing the manifestations of that period in the late 60s and early 70s when there was more economic equality. Jobs were better for blue-collar people and so on. What you saw during this 50 years is that more money was coming into the house, but it really reduced overall the middle class. The middle class, what you got is more people who are very, very rich, and then people who were not so very well off stayed about the same. So that income gap got larger. Is, you know, some of the other trends, there were more people went to college. You had a better chance with a better job if you went to college. Those sorts of things were clearly there. Also, more old people. The population mm-hmm. has gotten older, even though a lot of the immigrants were younger. There are more people living over 85 now, and we'll come back to that in a little while when we look at Hawaii. But what you can also see are some of the legacies of what's happened nationally, one of which is that immigration is just stopped. In effect, it's a trickle compared to what it was before. And this education and the income gap, the whole income issue, is still a very significant issue. And you could see it nationally that more people started to live in multi-generational families. So that's kind of what the picture looks like in a very general skeletal form over 50 years. What you see changing in Native Hawaiian and Pacific Island, there's one very interesting thing. One is that there's been more immigration from the Pacific Islands to the United States. But the big change is how many more there are percentage-wise. And that's driven by the number that immigrated, but also by a much higher percentage of people who are Native Hawaiian or Pacific Islanders who identify themselves as mixed race, who identify themselves with a multiple identity. And the degree to which Pacific Islanders and Native Hawaiian have done that is much higher than other people have done that sort of thing.
I remember when I was graduating from high school, which was 50 years ago. And, you know, when I was checking the box for college, it was like, okay, are you a Latin or are you Asian? You know, there was no Pacific Islander box to check.
Right. That's exactly right. You didn't have anything to check. So some of this, in effect, is a artificial change. But it's a very significant artificial change because it showed that when people wanted that opportunity, they could do it. It also shows it's kind of interesting that at a time when we think about identity as something so solid and so homogenous, at the same time, people were identifying their identity in a kind of complicated way, right? That there were mixed identities. And so it's not just that these places got more diverse. It's also the way people began to think about themselves. And we'll come back to that when we look at Hawaii a little more closely. The other interesting things about Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islanders now, the majority of Native Hawaiians live outside of Hawaii. That's been of some concern for a while. They see it as a brain drain or whatever, but that's certainly the case. Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders are slightly less educated when you look at the amount of people who went, the percentage of people who went to college. And one of the more interesting ones has to do with income. This may be a surprise, but the median income of Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders generally is about the same as the median family income of people in the United States. But this is an interesting twist on that. In Hawaii, two things. One, first of all, the Hawaii Native Hawaiians and so on make more money than they would if they were on the mainland, but they make less money in Hawaii than the average, which kind of suggests how hard it is to live here, right? Your income is higher, but it's not as high as others, and it's not as high as you really need to survive. So that's kind of what, those are sort of the changes that you see. But understand, and probably you're probably listening to me and saying, those are just very skeletal and very general, and they definitely are. If you want to think about changes over 50 years, you have to dig deeper, and digging deeper means looking more closely at specific things and specific cases. And that's why I got interested in the article in the Star Advertiser that talks about the impact of the Hokulea. And I think that's a very important cultural change to understand, because it really was very much a part of the Hawaii Renaissance, of the changes that have happened over the past 50 years. So let me stop before and see if you have any questions before I do that.
No, I mean, I think you're right, though. You know, it's that turning point, right? It's that sense of pride and the need to really broadcast that out.
Well, and I can express it in personal terms, because when I moved here in the early 70s and knew ashamedly almost nothing about Hawaii other than the fact that I wanted to live here, I walked right into Gabby Pahanui's music, the Sunday Manoa, the increase in the Hawaiian language, the flourishing development of local and Hawaiian theater, of which I was lucky enough to be a part of as an actor and a little bit of a writer. And I was experienced these things, and I didn't realize the significance. And this, it's hard to measure. You can't say that Hokulea caused these, but it certainly was a stimulus and part of the mix. And as the people who were on Hokulea say, it were profound changes, that not only in the kinds of things that we just mentioned, more immersion schools, more Hawaiian, and so on, but different ways of thinking about yourself, different ways of seeing the world, seeing how Hawaii is related to other indigenous places, and to develop a sense of identity, both with Hawaiians and also with local people, that was less assimilationist and less the legacy of the plantations. So what you really have, if you're going to understand Hawaii, what Hawaii went through in the past 50 years, and you want to do a good job in doing it in detail, you got to look at the cultural and you got to look at the economic. And I think that you really have to look at how the profound economic changes here. You know, this place has become much more part of the global economy. It's still very tourist oriented. It has some really fragile status in lots of different ways. You feel the limits of being on an island, even though you could get away from it more. But at the same time, you have this cultural renaissance that I think is in part as a reaction to all of these other things. So the final thing I want to say is, if you really want to know, as I would really like to know, in more detail, how this place has changed since 1976, or since I showed up in late summer of 1972, I think you would have to look at the mix and the tensions between cultural changes and cultural situations and economic changes and economic situations. And with a note of pessimism, I'll just close by saying, nobody does that kind of research here. We really don't have that kind of comprehensive analysis of what Hawaii is really like. It's very different than what we now know about the 19th century, because there's been a lot better work and understanding on that. But I think that's really how to understand Hawaii in lots of ways. This emphasis on cultural change that's endemic to Hawaii, at the same time being part of an economic, almost uncontrollable world economic order that pushes us around.
Well, I just had a very visceral experience going to the very first opera in Native Hawaiian, and to hear that story on that stage with a Metropolitan Opera star, you know, a Native Hawaiian, that was a chicken skin moment. But yeah, certainly it makes you pause and reflect on the history and how far Hawaii has come.
In Sally Mary's book that she wrote about 15 years ago, A Kind of History of Hawaii, she's an anthropologist, really spent a lot of time here. One of the ways that she starts the book is essentially what that opera is about, that the king had figured out that in order to protect Hawaii as an independent kingdom, he was going to have to reach out to, in diplomatic ways, to countries all over the world to establish relationships with them. And he sent people out to do that. So when we think about the history of this place as an island, as a specific culture, it certainly was that. But very early on, the king had figured out, if you want to survive, you've got to find linkages and friends somewhere else, kind of standard diplomacy. And that's what the hero of the opera does.
Yes, and that is the long view that the king had. But thank you so much, Neil.
You're welcome.
Appreciate your thoughts.
Take care.
That was our Longview contributor, Neil Milner. We will have links to the Pew Report and the Honolulu Star Advertiser story that he referenced on our website later today. Well, that does it for us today. Up tomorrow, we have a Hanaho show planned for you. The Vietnam War brings back all kinds of memories. We take time to reflect on refugee stories, and in particular, Operation Babylift, the Hawaii stories of Vietnamese children adopted by U.S. families. Have a memory of that time to share? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.